Hello and welcome. You're tuned into the best in true crime talk radio. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Along with me today on the journey, Mr. Tim Dennis. Hello, Tim.
Hello there.
We are in for a treat. Have an amazing guest joining us today. A lot of the cases we've discussed over the 9-10 years that we've been doing true crime, Tim, all seem to end up falling in this man's lap. He is Cyril Wecht, Dr. Cyril Wecht, an internationally acclaimed forensic pathologist, attorney, and medical legal consultant who's become famous for consulting on deaths with a high media profile. His expertise has been called upon in cases involving John F. Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King Jr., Elvis Presley, JonBenet Ramsey, Lacey Peterson, and Kurt Cobain, just to name a few. And he has a new book out, The Life and Deaths of Cyril Wecht, Memoirs of America's Most Controversial Forensic Pathologist. Thank you so much for joining us here today, sir.
No, thank you for inviting me. A pleasure to talk with you.
What a fascinating and strange life this must be to have to review deaths and examine these cases, things that to most of us would seem horrific. If you don't mind, just in a couple of the cases, of course, that we've covered on the show, there's always been questions that have been left. But one of the points I was curious about is in mentioning that your expertise was called upon for like cases with Kurt Cobain. There's been so much conjecture on the fact of, was this a murder that was covered up to look like a suicide or so on. How hard is it from the outside looking in at first to even start to get those, to get a full understanding of those cases? And then when you examine it, is it pretty easy to see, boy, this things just are not adding up?
Well, once in a while, some omission, act of negligence, or simply incorrect conclusion becomes immediately evident. But most of the time, it is not that clear. The differentiation between two opinions and medical conclusions is not dramatically and immediately clear. It becomes a matter of examining all the records, all the materials, doing whatever research may be necessary to check on some things, and then see whether or not you agree with the opinions of a previous pathologist if an autopsy had been done. It's not a matter usually of anybody being incompetent. Sometimes you encounter that. Most of the time, it is a difference of opinion based upon subjective interpretation of the facts and circumstances of the case. One should keep in mind in addressing this very good question you have posed is that the pathology, even though much more tangible and concrete and definitive than other areas of medicine, not because we pathologists are smarter, but because we have the opportunity to examine organs and tissues grossly, microscopically, that other doctors do not have, that even pathology, let alone all other branches of medicine, is not an absolute science. You yourself, I'll bet you, and a big percentage of your listeners will recall at some point in time in their lives, or loved ones, family members, close friends, or so on, where more than one opinion of a differing nature has been given as to whether or not one should undergo a particular surgical procedure, whether one should do this or do that, or so on. And what that all bespeaks of is the fact that medicine, as I've said, is not an absolute science. The only scientific field that is applicable in our area of forensic science utilization is cellular DNA. But everything else is subject to different opinions. So to bring it back to your question and answer it now in a definitive fashion, I look at everything. And if I agree, I agree. I'm not looking to be different or contrary or ornery or just to make money or so on. If I agree, I agree. And sometimes I can't help. But many times it is a difference of opinion, a difference of interpretation. One more thing I would say, that medical examiners and coroners do have a tendency, I think it's subconscious, it's not a malevolent conspiratorial cabal, to go along with law enforcement and district attorneys. These are the people they work with. They trust these people. They are their friends. They consider themselves to be on the same side. And that is why you get opinions like that sometimes, which upon further scrutiny do not bear up. I would say one more thing in that regard, and that is that forensic pathologists, all forensic scientists, are not, should not be part of the prosecution. Look at the National Academy of Sciences report in February 2009, makes that abundantly clear. I have been saying that for 40, 50 years. I'm not suggesting that they copied that from me, but it took a while for that to be set forth in that kind of definitive, unequivocal fashion, that you functioning, whether as a forensic pathologist, toxicologist, criminalist, psychiatrist, or any of the other forensic scientific specialists, you are not an extension of, you are not a legal ally of the prosecution. You are, should be, and must be an objective scientific fact finder. And that is something that regrettably hasn't happened. It took a long, long time for medical examiners to come around to accept the concept of positional asphyxiation, such as we see in the George Floyd case in Minneapolis. I've been talking about positional asphyxiation for 40, 50 years in some cases that occurred here in Pittsburgh. It isn't because I was brilliant. It's just because forensic pathologist, coroners found it just more comfortable to go along with the cops coming up with diagnoses, something that has been rejected by the majority of competent, experienced forensic scientists, this theory of excited delirium, just to give you an example, that somebody takes cocaine and they develop the strength of Superman. They can hurl 5-10 police officers off their backs in different directions and so on. That's the way these cases have been signed out. Excited delirium, poo-pooed by the Royal Canadian Police, banned in England, and so on. But that was the convenient way out. Many of these people then had a little bit of cocaine. So instead of calling it positional asphyxiation, as these people were being compressed on the ground, like we see in the George Floyd case, by 2, 3 or more cops, they said that he died as a result of excited delirium. How come the millions of people who use cocaine never have an incidence of excited delirium? And the only time that one saw that diagnosis was when there were these confrontations, altercations with law enforcement agencies. So this gives you a good idea. A long answer, but I hope it'll maybe set the basis for some of the other discussion.
It is. Thank you so much for giving an insight to that. But you bring up an interesting point then. If you come forward and you're able to show that this is most likely the situation, as you said, this should be an objective viewpoint coming in, not one that's set by the precedence of defense or prosecution, but just this is truth. When that is stated, and especially from somebody in your high of a profile, why is it not taken more seriously? I understand we want to feel as though we're supporting law enforcement so that they can do their job. But when we see that there's an issue like this, it isn't diminishing their job. It is simply helping them to be more effective at their job so that mistakes like this are not made.
Well, as I said, it's a longstanding mindset that colleagues of mine have inculcated into them without even realizing it. You know, it's just like religion. Some great theological philosopher, scholar once said, give me the kid for the first 5 years of his life and, I'll have what I need. And the overwhelming majority of what we see, whether it's Catholic, Protestant, Jewish, Muslim, what have you, it proves that point. So, that's what we encounter here. Secondly, everybody likes to talk about the concept of innocent until proven guilty, the fact of the matter is that consciously, if certainly subconsciously, once someone is charged with a crime, then there's a tendency to believe that that person really is guilty. And that person and his, her defense attorney, they have a difficult time. Just think, you're the pathologist, you're doing an autopsy, somebody, and the homicide detective comes in, and, he's your buddy, comes in, you've worked with him before, and so on. Maybe he's helped you out a little bit here and there, your wife's parking ticket, your son's marijuana charge, whatever, who knows. And anyway, you've got a nice, comfortable relationship, and the detective is saying to you, time of death here, Doc, is very important because we believe the husband did this, but he has a very good excuse after midnight. And, you're doing this autopsy now and you're trying to determine the approximate time of death using the criteria that have been around for centuries, rigor mortis, body stiffening, livor mortis, the gravitational settling of blood in the dependent parts of the body, depending upon the position of the body at the time of death, and algor mortis, body temperature. Well, these are not precisely scientific. They're fine for fictional programs, but they don't work out in real life like that. The range is significant, hours. So he's saying this to you. He's not saying, Doc, we got to do this or so on. But, he's telling you, we believe he did it, and if we got to show that it happened before midnight. And so, instead of saying time of death could have been somewhere between 12 midnight to 4 a.m. in the morning, then, you just say, time of death, I think, was before midnight. So that is to give an example, and that's the way it goes. So you deal with these things.
Okay, and I understand that, people have the CSI effect, where they watch a TV show, they think that's how it works, and that concept is not real. But if the police are coming in and they're saying, Dr. Wecht, listen, we know this guy did it. We need you to show that it happened before midnight, that this would have taken place here. But like you said, there's such a wide window of interpretation. How does someone step into that and give a, obviously you want to support the work and the rest of the evidence that's pointing to this person. You don't want to give a shadow of doubt because there's actually a 4-hour window this could fit into. But how do we do that objectively and not seem as though we're swaying to the opinion of the police as opposed to giving the full, scope of what the science tells us?
Well, you just have to make it a point that you are a forensic scientist and you got to keep an open mind and do not accept anybody else's conclusions until you have put everything together. And then that's what I do as a consultant. I'm not under any pressure from anybody. If I can help the consulting attorney, fine. If I can't, then I tell him. But I don't have those kinds of pressures on me. And that is why in a large number of cases in different states around the country over these past 40, 50 years, my testimony has resulted in verdicts that were diametrically opposed to the charges that had been leveled. I don't limit myself to the defense. I testify. In fact, I testify more frequently for the prosecution because I do autopsies for coroners and district attorneys in 4 surrounding counties here in southwestern Pennsylvania. As a result, I'm a witness for the prosecution more frequently than for the defense. Remember, prosecution attorneys, whether, whatever it's Kansas City or Minneapolis or Miami, Florida, or you name it, they have their forensic pathologists working in the medical examiner coroner's office, so they don't need outside experts. Once in a while, they may reach out to get an additional expert to buttress their case, especially if they're being challenged. But for the most part, they just run with their own local pathologist. And as a result, you know, my private consultations in criminal cases, homicides, are more frequently from defense attorneys. In civil cases, I consult with both plaintiff and defense. And I'm proud of the fact that I have cases from both sides, because I've been doing this now for 62 to 21. We're talking now 59 years. You know, I would not have been able.
Now, again, one of the questions.
I would not have been able to maintain, you know, my credibility.
If, right.
If I, you know, were seen to be a shyster, you know, somebody who was available just because he's being paid.
But with that said, on one side, if you have defense asking you to examine this case and it doesn't add up to what they were hoping, will they dismiss you? Does the other side ever then pick you up as a consultant?
Well, no, you can't do that. I mean, once I'm consulted by one side, I don't. That's happened a couple times. I have had that happen a few times, and I cannot then go to the other side. As a matter of fact, even where I haven't been formally consulted, but where I have spoken out, then I can't. I just make it a point. It's not that it's just legally an obstacle, but I just can't do it. I'll give you two good examples. Freddie Gray, an African-American young man in Baltimore who died as a result of being overpowered by police and having his spinal cord injured and so on. One of the defense attorneys for one of the cops called me, but I had already spoken out on that case, and I said, I'm sorry, but I don't feel it would be proper for me to consult with you. And then more recently, and even more dramatically, I received a call from one of the attorneys representing Derek Chauvin, the cop who's charged with homicide in the George Floyd case in Minneapolis. But because I had spoken out very much, expressing my views, I said, I'm sorry, I can't do that. So it's a matter of, you know, your own idea of what your ethical standards are.
When you are called into a case to, in some cases, re-examine the work that's been done, are you asked to redo the autopsy, or are you just asked to re-examine the evidence that was collected from the initial autopsy and crime scene?
Sometimes I do a second autopsy if the attorney is involved early on, and if the attorney is sharp and recognizes the fact that there can be different opinions and so on, then I do a second autopsy. Regrettably, most often the attorney isn't brought on board for a while. The body's been buried. It's been a while. The attorney isn't that sharp and not thinking about it, or funds may not be available. So most of the time, I would not be doing a second autopsy. Other times, I am there doing a second autopsy. I'll give you an example. Remember some years ago, a gentleman from an African country named Diallo in New York City was shot multiple times. He hadn't done anything. He was just walking up the stairwell to his apartment and on a mistaken identity, whatever. And I went to New York and I did a second autopsy there. You know, going over every bullet wound, determining entrance and exit. There are a lot of cases in which I wish that I could have been able to do the original autopsy or at least the second autopsy then. You know, it's just sometimes sometimes if you're looking for certain features, then that may have been obscured, not deliberately or malevolently, but just by way of the autopsy procedure and the way things are cut into and so on, then no sense in doing a second autopsy. So many times I tell the attorney, save your money. You know, it's not worth it. I turned down a lot of cases where I could have made money just by doing the second autopsy, but because I did not feel that it was likely to yield results that could be objectively evaluated, I told them no.
In the case I brought up at the beginning with Kurt Cobain, being that there was so many differing opinions, especially socially, when you examined that case, did you find that it was self-inflicted, even though some of the evidence appeared to show different elements, or was it something you think might have been murder?
Yes, I was consulted actually by the people who made the excellent documentary Soaked in Bleach, and I studied that case extensively, exhaustively. They had done a very good job in bringing together other people, investigators, and they had obtained all the records. So based upon my review and evaluation and analysis of all the records and circumstances, I arrived at the conclusion set forth in that documentary, which I shall repeat now in response to your question. I believe that Kurt Cobain's death was most likely a homicide. I do not believe that it was a suicide. He had a level of heroin that it could if one could divide it into four parts, it would have been enough to kill four people. Now, it is true that addicts develop a tolerance, which is the medical term for people who develop an ability to handle more of a drug than normally would be expected. However, that level was just really off the chart. And then he had his own drug kit. He had a beautiful little brown leather case in which he had a syringe, a needle, a tourniquet, the drugs, Band-Aid, anesthetic wipe, and so on. But what you would have to believe in this case, if you go along with suicide, is that having injected himself, at which point he would have been in a very, very high mood of exaltation, to say the least, that he then, as was found, took the needle off the syringe, cleaned them both, placed them back inside the leather kit, took the tourniquet off his arm, placed that back in the kit, and then proceeded to shoot himself with a shotgun. That's so ridiculous, so absurd. They never thought otherwise when they went there. They just assumed that it was a suicide, and they failed to collect, look for physical evidence, and they never really properly pursued that case. And that's why I believe that came out with the wrong conclusion.
Well, there are many cases, Dr. Wecht, where they later things will come to light. An expert will step forward and make a claim like you are, and the case will be reexamined or reopened with that in mind. Why do you think a case like Kurt Cobain has never been officially reopened and examined? Is it fear that they'll make a fool of themselves for having not completed the initial investigation properly? Or is there something else at work here?
I think in most cases, like Cobain, it's a matter exactly as you have portrayed that they made their decision and so on, and now to come forward and and say, "Gee, we made the mistake," and so on and so forth, as well as the procedural hassle of getting the case. I think that those are the reasons. In other instances, then you have things of a more serious nature involved, like with the assassinations of JFK, RFK, and MLK. I believe there is a matter of behind the scenes governmental control, or I should say on the scene, not necessarily behind the scenes. So, but eliminating those political assassinations and just dealing with other deaths, which have become well-known, famous, infamous, controversial. I think it's a matter of, you know, the decision was made. Sometimes new facts come to light, and the individuals who were involved are no longer around, and so on. And so, you know, it's just it's a real hassle, and so they don't want to deal with it.
Have you ever been influenced by the government, especially on bigger cases like that, where they have tried to control the outcome of your investigation instead of allowing necessarily the truth to be told?
No. I personally have never been involved in that kind. I mean, not direct pressures. I've, you know, I in my dealings over these almost 58 years with the JFK assassination and 53 years with the MLK and RLK assassinations, you know, I've dealt with pressures that have been brought to bear on me in other ways, but not directly by governmental agencies contacting me or threatening me. No, they, but I've paid a heavy price. And I discuss this, in fact, in my book, Life and Deaths of Cyril Wecht, Memoirs of America's Most Controversial Forensic Pathologist. I discuss two legal trials that I had to go through, one in Allegheny County, 79 to 81, and the other one by the U.S. attorney here, 2006 to 2009, cost me a huge amount of money, incredible amount of time and effort. And I paid a price, but I was completely exonerated and defeated significant prosecutorial authorities. So, you know, I paid a price. So, and I do believe, without being paranoid, that if not necessarily direct contact, just the overall background scenario of my involvement and my speaking out on other cases has certainly contributed to these legal actions that were brought against me, both of which were quite spurious, but both of which resulted in trials that I had to deal with. Fortunately, I had excellent attorneys, and I prevailed.
And we do have a link up for Dr. Wecht's book and for his website on today's program guide, so you can find that easily. And remember, folks, pick up the book, read it, rate it, and review it on these sites so that they become higher profile books. People can find them easier and hear about them. And it really goes a long way to help the authors that we support on this program. When you are faced then with these type of cases, and you are now kind of the one underneath the prosecution microscope, it's really remarkable, because so many people have done that and find that their careers are left in ruins afterwards. And you said you had great attorneys that helped you on this, Dr. Wecht, but still sometimes just in, you know, the influence of planting that seed with the public can create derision, and people start questioning how authoritative they really are in these cases. But it really seemed not to have affected you in the long run. What do you attribute that to, that you were able to continue on and not have those cases, even though you won them, not cast a aspersions on your career going forward?
Well, I can only say that many people were good, strong supporters, including, by the way, for example, the district attorneys and coroners in the counties that I referred to before, for whom I do autopsies. They continued during my trial, which was a 6-8 week trial, for example, in 2006. I continued to do autopsies and even testified one day. You're going to find this absurd. You wouldn't believe it in a work of fiction. I finished my case on the fifth floor of the federal building here in Pittsburgh at 4 o'clock, went downstairs two flights and testified in another federal courtroom in a homicide case in which I had done the autopsy for one of the coroners. I then my courage and perseverance, and I had some money, and it cost me a great deal of money. And I'll be more specific, as I had $4 million and a marvelous law firm, K&L Gates, we which represented me in that case, they forgave $6.2 million. So that case cost more than $10 million. But I was forgiven $6.2 million because the attorneys knew I didn't have the money. But it was nice of them to have done that. So what do I attribute to strong support, wonderful family, my wife, my children, and friends? But you know, a lot of people turn away from you, and newspapers and news media and so on. But they all came around. For example, in my case where I beat the U.S. attorney who had charged me with 84 felony count indictment with the omniscient, omnipotent FBI eagerly and aggressively involved through a terrible FBI agent who had been discredited and sent from the New Jersey office to Pittsburgh. You know, I just prevailed. And by the time they was winding down and there had been a hung jury, and before it was argued before the newly appointed federal judge, which the Third Circuit Court of Appeals that reviews cases for Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Delaware, Third Circuit, said should be done, a judge with fresh eyes and biased opinion, their words. I already had the newspapers here editorializing in my favor, and I had people writing in, including some of the very prominent Republicans. I'm a Democrat, have been active through the years, former U.S. Senator Arlen Specter, and so on. So, you know, it's a combination of things, but it's very hard to do. You need courage. You need friends. You need supporters. You need money. And you need damn good attorneys. And that's the answer to your question. How did I prevail? And, you know, it kind of made me then a much more sought after expert and a kind of a local hero. Very proud of the fact that, I walk down the streets. If I'm there, when people walk down the streets before COVID, you know, a lot of people would just shout out or blow a horn or so on. Not that I sought that, but that happened. But I could have been totally, totally destroyed. Even if I hadn't gone to prison, I would have lost my medical license, my legal license.
Wow.
It would have, in fact, that's what they wanted me to do. They wanted me to plead guilty to one count. They offered that. That's how horrible, how terrible these people were. They said to my attorney that if I would plead guilty to one count, of an 84-count indictment, one count, they said I would not go to prison, I would not even be fined, and that was it, I would have to acknowledge. So I told them, no way. But that just shows you the marvelous and the power. People have no idea the power of a U.S. attorney. Read about it if you're a lawyer or interested in criminal justice. Read what Supreme Court Justice Jackson, who headed up the Nuremberg trials for us, read what he said about U.S. attorneys. The power of that office is incredible. They answer essentially to nobody other than maybe the president. They're not even directly under the control of the attorney general.
Good grief. How is that possible? That seems like it's an abuse of power as well.
Oh, I agree. And they use it. They use it. Remember, they have the power of the government and the total endless reserves, money, and anybody, any expert, any test, anything they want to do. You know, they don't have to go and get approval. When people consult me many times, and they have to get approval from the court to get money to pay for an expert. Even district attorneys sometimes, have to check their budget and so on. It's quite different when it comes to the U.S. Attorney's Office. They do whatever they want to do. And this is discussed, by the way, in my book. I not only a couple dozen of my famous, infamous cases in this country and some fascinating cases from countries abroad, but I discuss the criminal justice system. I talk about my trials, and people have been finding it fascinating, truly, truly fascinating. much more intellectually provocative than things that you would read about in a work in a world of fiction.
You know, you have looked into and consulted on so many amazing stories and parts of history. You are a slice of each one of these cases. Are there some cases that stand out to you that you wish, boy, this is one I just can't put away. I can't get it out of my head. I wish I'd never seen this. I just can't guess that with all the horrors you have been witness to, I can't even understand how you can sleep at night, honestly, Dr. Wecht. What cases kind of come to the top for you of just something that is so disturbing, so unusual that, you know, it will never leave you?
Well, the number one case, of course, is the JFK assassination, not only because it was the president of the United States, but even from a forensic, scientific, medical, legal investigative standpoint, it is a case fraught with all kinds of complexities and the way in which it was manipulated and handled and covered up by the government. And then similarly, Robert F. Kennedy and Martin Luther King cases because of their importance. And then there have been other cases that trouble make still today. We talked about Kurt Cobain, the JonBenet Ramsey case, Secretary of Commerce Ron Brown. These are some cases that come to mind where I believe the true answers have not been revealed.
Well, obviously, JonBenet Ramsey, her case continues to still capture the attention of the world, which is, you know, kind of strange to me in the sense that there are so many children that lose their lives on a daily basis. But that case just keeps coming around. Do you believe it's because people really feel no justice has ever been meted out, and that's why there's this fascination with that case?
You know, you make a very good point in the context of your question about so many other children. That is very fascinating. In fact, around the, you know, children, regrettably, tragically, are being killed by abusive parents and sometimes by third parties every day somewhere in America. How did this case come to? It was a combination of things. A beautiful little girl, like a beauty queen, that alone, you know, when you just look at that picture, I remember when I first saw it, I didn't know whether I had been out of the country with my family on Christmas, New Year's holiday when this happened. And I hadn't followed it because we didn't get the newspapers down there. And when I came back, I first looked at it. I wasn't sure, was this a midget or whatever, the way her mother had dolled her up, just incredibly. I mean, I found it deplorable. That case, I have written a book on that, Who Killed JonBenet Ramsey, with Charles Bosworth, a very fine writer, St. Louis Post-Dispatch newspaper reporter, an excellent writer. And we have this book, which sets forth everything, including the autopsy report. So JonBenet Ramsey is a case that continues to bother me. Secretary of Commerce Ron Brown, a case that bothers me because it was not properly handled.
So, well, we'll cover that in a second. But let me ask you on the JonBenet Ramsey case. So much is said about it, you know, that her parents obviously were covering for someone, they believe. And a lot of people believe it falls squarely on the shoulders of her brother. Can you give us some insight into your investigation and your thoughts on the JonBenet Ramsey case?
Yes, as I set forth in my book, I do not believe that the brother, 3 years older, Burke, was involved. I do not believe that he was involved. I believe that this death was not intended to be a homicide. No intent to harm. The little girl was there, but I do believe that it occurred, accidentally. But from a legal standpoint, of course, it would turn out to be homicide. I believe that it is very likely that the father had been engaging in some kind of perverted sexual activity, digital penetration of the vaginal area, as set forth in the microscopic findings of the autopsy report, chronic inflammation in the vaginal lining, focal erosion of the 7 o'clock position, which is where digital penetration of the let's say if you're a woman on a gynecology table and the examiner, you know, think of the index finger going in to feel for lesions, it would be at the 7 o'clock position. And then under polarized light, birefringent material was found, the most ubiquitous common source of which in every household would be talcum powder. When you put those all together, I think you have a strong case for that kind of digital manipulation. And then when you then further correlate it with other things, this so-called outside intruder, how did he get in? Not awakening anybody, knowing where the little girl's bedroom was, being able to get her out of there without awakening her or her brother in the next door bedroom, and knowing about a back set of stairs that led into a basement with a room that was so obscure that the detectives who had been called there about 6:30 in the morning when she was found missing never even knew existed. They didn't even know there was such a room. A maid who had worked there for a year did not know for several months that there was such a room. It was about 1 o'clock that day when John Ramsey, who had invited over his then best friend, Fleet White, another multimillionaire businessman who soon came to be his worst enemy, he said to Fleet White, let's go look again. It's at 1 o'clock. Cops are gone. He takes him downstairs. He opens up the room, and according to Fleet White, before one's eyes could even become adjusted, as the light was turned on, he was already exclaiming, oh my God, there she is beneath a blanket. So anyway, back to our outside intruder. So the outside intruder, he knew about the back room, and he had his pleasures with the little girl. And then he decided, you know what? I'm going to make this a profitable evening as well. I'm going to make some money. So he looks for pen and paper, which he had not bothered to bring. He finds it in the middle of the night, total darkness. He starts to write a note, doesn't like it, crumples up the piece of paper, throws it to the floor, and starts to write again. And the note says, we represent a small foreign faction, and the ransom demand was $118,000. You like that sum? $118,000. Not $100 or $125 or $150, $118, which is exactly the amount of money that John Ramsey had made as a bonus from his company the year before. How many people knew that? And then after doing that, he leaves the house. So this highly malignant, horrible monster, but a pretty clever, cunning, manipulative, in his own terrible way, quite courageous to have done everything that he has accomplished. He makes one mistake. You know what that is? I've asked audiences over the years, tens of thousands of people, everybody just stares up at me. Well, he leaves the body. He leaves the body. 45-pound body. You just wrote the note. What in the hell? You went through all of this, and then you write the note, and then you leave the body. It's 45-pound body. You take it with you. You throw it in a sewer, in the river, in the back of your car, wherever. He leaves the body. That is the outside intruder theory of the JonBenet Ramsey case for anybody who wants to buy it.
Unbelievable. Right. That is the part, you know, that stood out so much. Why leave this note? Why do these things but leave the body in this place? I mean, if this person was able to navigate through a house, get into this basement, do the horrible things that he did, get upstairs, write these notes, cast them aside, continue to make it, he certainly had the ability to carry that little girl out of the house and do what he wanted elsewhere, not under the roof where he could potentially be caught.
Of course.
That was so strange. With that said, we had a very strange altercation many years ago when we were visiting the Stanley Hotel in Estes Park, Colorado. This small man came up to me and was talking to me about something. He wanted to show me something on his computer and was talking to me. And just he was a very odd little man. And when he left, I had a gentleman walk up to me and he said, what did that guy want with you? And I said, oh, he was talking to me about ghosts and strange things. Why? And he said, you know, and he flips out his badge and shows me he's a police officer. He goes, I'm off duty and attending this conference. He goes, but that's our number one suspect in the JonBenet Ramsey murder. This same guy shows up a year later at the hotel when we're doing a conference there and proceeds to tell other people and show them pictures of the house. He could point to different places on the house of that he knew about. And then supposedly a ghostly apparition picture he captured of JonBenet Ramsey. Just a very creepy, strange guy who had also been following some of the attendees that were small, petite, little blonde women around downtown. It was very unusual. And again, you obviously had a much broader overview of this case and seeing what you believe it to be. But it was so surreal to be in that moment and hear this guy keeps showing up and the police are there and they're telling us who they think this guy is and why they think he is this killer. And I'm like, my God, first of all, he's trespassing. Can't you go bust him and find out what was going on? It was just such a strange moment in mine and Tim's history to encounter this guy, not once, but twice, and have the police actively looking into him at both accounts. It was just a very strange deal. But again, things didn't add up. I couldn't understand, you know, how somebody could go in and out so cleanly as this, and make these moves. So you believe it was Mr. Ramsey that is the perpetrator of this crime and did this horrible thing. Do you believe that his wife supported this, that his son might be aware of it, or were they left in the dark about all of this?
I don't think the son knew what was going on. By the way, there was a unplanned recorded note made. The son came down to ask what was going on, and I think the Ramseys were talking with a relative in California, and they told him just to be quiet and just go back to his room. I think that you know, it played out as I have explained, and you know, I just don't believe that there's any basis for an outside intruder. All this time, no trace, no physical evidence of any kind was ever found, you know, you think of everything that he did, that he would have had to have done, the things that I've talked about, going into that house and knowing all those things and so on. Think about it. It's absurd.
Could I ask, when you worked on as a consultant for the case on Elvis Presley, was that something that you did again as a third party, or were you at all involved in the autopsy and the investigation as it unfolded?
No, that was as a third party. I was consulted by one of the national news media. I think it was ABC, whatever it was, in any event. And they sent me all the materials. And then I pointed out Elvis Presley died as a result of acute combined drug toxicity. He had 11 central nervous system depressant drugs. My God, he spent 3-4 hours a day in the bathroom. He was so constipated from the effects of those drugs. They said that the diameter of his colon was as big as a small man's thigh. The way it was put out that he died from heart disease, that was a fraud. The medical examiner, Jerry Francisco in Tennessee, ruled that it was not his case. Nevertheless, even though the autopsy was then being done privately at Memphis Baptist Hospital by Dr. Muir, he, Francisco, went over there and he announced to the news media that Elvis Presley had died as a result of heart disease. The autopsy hadn't even been completed. Obviously, the slides hadn't been made to study microscopically. Toxicological analyses hadn't come back. And he made that announcement. Elvis Presley had a minimally enlarged heart, considering his size and girth, really nothing significant. He died from 11 central nervous system depressant drugs.
Yikes. Again, at that point, why cover up? You know, obviously, that wasn't a murder. It wasn't a conspiratorial angle to it. Why do you think, again, was that a case of just straight up incompetence? Or was it?
No, not incompetence. Francisco is a board certified forensic pathologist, and he knows you don't speak out until you get toxicology results. Number one. Number two, he had no business in the case. In any event, as I've already said, he had ruled that it wasn't his case. Why? This is pure conjecture on my part now. I can't answer this scientifically. My conjecture is Elvis Presley was a major industry. There was a time in America, I remember reading once, that one out of every 11 or 12 people in America owned an Elvis Presley record. I just feel that they didn't want to, you know, tarnish that and harm that overall reputation. As I say, not a homicide. All the drugs had been prescribed by Dr. Nicopoulos, who was the live-in sycophantic Graceland doctor. Anything that Elvis wanted, Dr. Nick prescribed. An upper going into a performance, something during, coming out of the performance, 3 o'clock in the morning, you may want to go to a dentist and nobody could see him, or play handball. So whatever he wanted, Dr. Nicopoulos ordered. So there was no intent to harm. And indeed, that's what happened. As to why he was covered up, then I believe that is the reason why. I can't think of any other reason.
All right.
But the truth has been exposed. And
right.
I want to make it clear that Dr. Muir, who did the autopsy, he never said that it was heart disease. He pointed out the drugs, but his opinions were ignored, and they just ran with what the medical examiner had to say.
The Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman murder, again, having to sift through that and the photographs and the evidence that was collected, you know, there are still people, and it's strange to sit there and think, how can, you know, you sit on the fence and still question if O.J. Simpson did this crime. In your opinion, is there enough evidence? Because they, you know, it seems like they didn't find enough to correlate with the amount of violence and activity, aside from the cut on a finger and a few stray blood droplets that we understand. How does a guy do a murder like that? I've been to that area. I'm baffled by how you can murder two people without alerting more people. And he had to have been covered in blood. What are your thoughts on this? And do you believe that OJ was involved, or do you believe that he was involved, but there were more than one person involved in this with him?
You're very sharp. I believe that OJ was there with the second person, and I believe the second person was his son, Jason. Your point about the blood is very important. There are 17 wounds in one person, 22 wounds in another. When you cut the carotid artery and the jugular veins on the side of the neck, blood spurts literally 2, 3, 4, 5 feet. And you've got two young adult people in good health fighting for their lives. The blood pressure is very high. When you're going to cut those vessels, that blood is really going to spurt. Where did all the blood go? They went to OJ's house. They searched every sink and toilet and shower and tub, and found no evidence of blood. There was just one drop of blood on the sink, and that was shown probably to have been planted because it contained an anticoagulant substance found in the tube at your doctor's office when he draws blood from you. See, there definitely was a second person, and I believe it was his son, and he just bit the bullet to cover for his son because, you know, he would have been involved. Ron Goldman's presence was quite unexpected. I think that Jason went there with his father to confront Nicole. She was supposed to have gone to the restaurant where Jason worked for dinner that night, and she went somewhere else. He was very angry and disturbed. He was a quite unpleasant, angry young man. And then Ron Goldman shows up with a pair of glasses that she had left at a restaurant where she had dined. And, you know, I don't know what words and how things got out of hand, but they did. And that's what happened. And that's why I think that O.J., then was there, but I do not believe that he was the perpetrator, really, when you think of all that blood.
Right.
Where did it go? All the clothing, the instrumentality.
But if he was on site, how did he, like you said, they checked showers and sinks and everything. How did he get clean from that? Even if his son committed the murders, the splatter ratio and radius should have been big enough in a violent altercation like that to have affected OJ, unless he's literally standing 12 feet away watching his son butcher two people. What do you think the
I think the answer is, yeah, he could not have been close enough. And for whatever reason, whether the murders had just already occurred and he arrived, or whether he was just standing back a little distance or whatever. No, I can't tell you, except here again, we're dealing with the total absence of blood. Where in the world? And, you know, every one of us have been cut. And remember, I remember if you're at a body of water, a lake or an ocean, and you think, well, I'll just go in and wash it off. It doesn't happen, does it? You come out and you find you still got blood where. So, you know, how do you get rid of all that? How do you get rid of all of that? But he and the answer is that it wasn't there to get rid of.
In each one of these cases and instances, again, you're looking at presidents and senators and celebrities and high profile children's cases. On the regular, has there ever been a case that comes across because of the brutality or nature of it, you've just stepped aside and said, you know, I don't even want to be involved in this, or because there is a call for justice, do you step up to each one of these cases?
No. There's no case in which I have excused myself because it was too violent. Not that I delight in dealing with cases of terrible violence, but that's the nature of the work that we do. You should see what some people have done to their bodies committing suicide. I don't even want to describe it. It's too disgusting to even talk about. In other cases in which people have been mutilated by an assailant. But, you know, I don't excuse myself for that reason. No, I excuse myself sometimes, as I've already told you, in cases where I've spoken out and become actively involved and just did not feel, even though I was not formally consulted or had told somebody that I could not help them, that I did not then, you know, swing over to the other side or where I had talked too much to news media. Then I had to decline the cases, as with the cops in the Freddie Gray case in Baltimore and the George Floyd case with the cops in Minneapolis.
It's just astounding to me the kind of work that goes into these cases. And I'm curious about something now, Dr. Wecht, having such a long career, you've seen now that police that had the foresight 30, 40, 50 years ago to put away that pair of underwear, put away a piece of evidence that might have DNA on it, not realizing that at some point we might be able to test that. And now those cases are being cracked 30, 40, 50 years later because of this. What do you personally think will be the next key element? Something that maybe a lot of people have overlooked. Is there something evidence-wise we should be keeping for the next generation of investigators that science may have finally caught up to look into this element?
Well, I can't imagine or even theorize about something better than cellular DNA. And there have been some, you know, sophisticated variations of DNA testing. But I think that clothing articles and other materials certainly should be properly preserved. There are more than 400 cases which the Innocence Project has shown to have been false through DNA testing. And who knows, I'm sure much, much more, many more, multiples of that number are people who would have been exonerated if they were aware, if they were still alive, if they had the money to pursue it, the intelligence to pursue it, somebody to support them on the outside, or so on. So I think that in any case, especially whether, you know, some dispute or so on, it behooves the defense attorney in that case to make it a matter of record and a formal request that all materials be properly preserved for further testing then or at a later date.
Is there any inherent flaws to the current DNA testing? Because I've heard both sides of this controversial method. You know, obviously we think, no, DNA is the answer. But what issues do you see in utilizing DNA as the measure of guilt or innocence in some of these cases?
Well, number one, DNA is not a a major factor or a critical factor in the overwhelming majority of cases. It's a small percentage of cases in which DNA comes into play. That's number one. Number two, the competence and the credibility and the honesty and the integrity of the people doing the test. But if the test is done by someone honest, then there is no challenge. There is no longer any dispute about the scientific validity of DNA, and, you know, absent, as they say, that the test was not done properly or so on. But if it is done, then that is it. There's no, I'm not aware of any challenge to cellular DNA. I know of none. It's accepted, and it excludes you to the rest of the world, everybody who's ever been on the earth before, except for your identical twin.
Has there ever been a case that when you first examined it and thought, okay, I believe, like in JonBenet Ramsey's case, it was the father. In this case, I believe it was the son. In this case, I believe it was the mother or the butler that did it, only to years later find out through DNA it was somebody else completely? Or has that not affected the outcome of any of your investigations?
I can't think of a case in which I've been involved where DNA has come in subsequently to show that what was determined at trial proved to be erroneous. I don't say that arrogantly, but in response to your question, I just can't think of a case like that in which I have been involved.
Do you ever sit there and watch some of these high-profile cases that you have not been called in to play out? And as attorney and a forensic pathologist, sit there and think, why are they not asking this question? Why are they not pushing this aspect of the case? And do you ever reach out on your own, or do you only reach out when they ask for your expertise?
Well, I'm not a TV person. My wife and I don't watch much TV. We're very busy. My wife is also an attorney, works here in my office, manages it. And we just don't have a lot of time, and we're not big TV fans. But I do follow things. I get four newspapers, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, USA Today, and my local Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. So I do follow things. Yes, there are cases where I read about them, and I wonder why such and such was not looked into or asked about. But I don't bite into a case. I've done cases pro bono over the years, gotten involved in cases that I've read about early on. A case that is underway, a case in which there are people involved, I never call or write or email directly or through somebody else and say, you know, how come you're not doing this? No, that would be, I don't have that kind of an ego.
Do they ever ask for your expertise on the whodunit aspect or only specifically on the science of this case?
Generally, the science. For example, I just had a call today from one of the national newspapers going to be doing a review of the Emma Nicole Smith case in which I was involved. I did the second autopsy, the autopsy on her son, Daniel. I was going to do her autopsy, but they kept the body around too long and didn't work out. So I get called and then review cases in the past. I would say in the course of a month, I will receive at least two calls from news media around the country, a newspaper or TV or TV asking me about something. When I review an autopsy report, let them know what I think about it. Is something a death in their jurisdiction? Or so on, or anniversary celebrations, and so on. So that arises quite often.
In the case of serial killers, I'm curious, you know, obviously your job, looking as a forensic pathologist, looking at these cases, do you sometimes see threads connecting one case to another that maybe law enforcement has overlooked? And is it your job then to bring that out to their attention, or just to say, this is what's going on in this case alone?
No, no. As I've already said, if I'm involved in a case, then I'll let them know what I think and what should be done and make suggestions and recommendations and so on. Absolutely. But if I'm not involved in a case, I don't butt in.
Do you get much pushback from law enforcement when you do something like that because it doesn't fit their narrative of what they're trying to accomplish?
No, I would say, you know, most of the time, if your suggestions are valid and so on, most of the time they'll follow through and do what is necessary.
In wrapping up, I know we've had a lot of your time here, and I appreciate
it. Yeah, wrap it up, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
The book, again, The Life and Deaths of Cyril Weck, Memoirs of America's Most Controversial Forensic Pathologist. Just as we say goodbye here today, what in sitting back and looking to put this book together, was there any aspect of your history that was even kind of a surprise to you to revisit and share in this book?
Well, no surprise to me. I got a good memory for good and bad. And then I worked with my co-author, Jeff Seawald, who's a very good, experienced, successful writer who's won awards. So he did a good job, and we worked together and spent a lot of time. So nothing has surprised me. And there are memories that sometimes I wish about things that I might have handled differently, stated or performed something differently or so on. Yes, but, and there are some things that indeed I've been reminded of that happened a long time ago in more detail than I have continued to remember, but there's nothing that is shocking that I have suppressed in my cerebral cortex to the point of making believe that it never happened. No, that's something I would not ever want to do.
Will there be some surprises and shock in this book to people that have followed your career and a lot of these famous cases? Will there be some of those moments?
Yes. Oh, yes, there will be a lot of interesting surprises to people who have followed my career. I've gotten some wonderful comments from people, professionals, regular folks, doctors, lawyers, all kinds of teachers, just regular folks. Yes, I would say, including some people who are friends of mine. So they have been surprised and learned a lot. So I think that people who don't know me will find a lot of stuff that is quite surprising to them.
Well, thank you very much for your commitment to truth and justice. And thank you for coming on the show today, Dr. Weck. We really
do appreciate it. I thank you for the opportunity, and you're an excellent interviewer and a pleasure. And I hope that your listeners have found it interesting, and that people will find it desirable to obtain the book. Thank you very much.
Thank you. The link is up in today's guide, folks, so make sure you click on it and order a copy of the book. Rate and review. Well, all right, Tim, it's time to kick open the case files of dumb crimes and stupid criminals.
It's Crayon News story time.
What happened with this dude, Christ Bearer? I heard he cut his penis off and then jumped off a balcony.
Suspect pulls gun from butt, shoots twice at Denver police.
What is your emergency?
Hello, I need help.
And what's the problem?
I'm too high.
You're too high?
Yeah.
All right, Tim. This is a weird week. There's just so many weird, I don't even know. Let's just get right into it.
Okay.
$3,000 worth of toothbrushes have been stolen from Shoppers Drug Mart. Toilet paper, okay, I kind of get it, uh-huh. Right?
Yeah.
Maybe baby formula. We're in a weird world crisis. We need food. We need sustenance. If things do fall apart here in the spring with food delivery or whatever, we've got baby food and baby formula, right? Sure. That could sustain a person.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Toothbrushes, Tim.
Yeah.
Toothbrushes.
Well,
we use the same toothbrush through all 4 years of college. How is that a commodity that's needed I don't understand.
I do, Dave. I get it. There's not only dental hygiene here, Dave, but anybody who's gone through military service could tell you that a toothbrush serves multiple uses. Not only do you get your teeth clean, but if you are particularly anal about the way you clean your toiletry type.
Yeah, I get it.
Devices.
Oh my god.
You've got other things to scrub with it. So, carry on.
This is your when you think 3,000 toothbrushes, how many do you think that equates to?
3,000 toothbrushes?
Yeah, how much money 3,000. Yeah, so you think $3,000 equates to 3,000 toothbrushes?
Well, how much money is that? I'm going to go $25,000.
No, maybe I'm not phrasing the question. Okay. The toothbrushes were stolen. They were worth $3,000. How many toothbrushes do you think equate to $3,000?
Oh, how many? Okay, all right. Divide by $7 or $6 a piece.
Where are you buying your toothbrushes from that are $7 a piece?
Well,
do they brush for you? Do you just put them in your mouth and then they start scrubbing back and forth for you? You don't even have to hold them at that kind of price?
You don't buy spin brushes?
What kind of expensive world does you know what? You don't have 11 children. That's what it comes down to. You're allowed to have good things. I forgot, Tim. I'm sorry.
Actually, spin brushes are more expensive than $7. Spin brushes are like $9 to $10 a piece.
Well, when they said $3,000 worth of toothbrushes, I'm just assuming this guy's just got like shopping carts full of toothbrushes. I'm wondering, how the hell does he get out? Turns out it was only 14 toothbrushes.
14?
Because he seems to have your taste in toothbrushes.
So he bought the expensive kind.
No, he didn't buy. He stole. It seems the individual involved in a recent theft from Shoppers Drug Mart late last week prioritizes oral hygiene, as apparently Tim does. According to Steinbach RCMP, that's the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, Tim, the home of Dudley Do-Right.
I'll help you now.
A male dressed in dark clothing entered the store during regular hours on Friday and stole 14 electric toothbrushes valued at roughly $3,000. 14 toothbrushes they're all at the average of about $214.29.
I'd hate to be your dentist. He's probably got to chip off like about a foot of tartar off your teeth.
No, as a matter of fact, I will have you know, at the ripe old age of 53, I have one cavity in my mouth, period. I have many cavities throughout my body, but only one in my teeth. And I don't even believe that was legitimately a cavity. I have very strong, well-taken care of choppers.
Well, then you gargle with battery acid, my friend, because you've got to be a genetic freak.
I am a bit of a genetic freak. I only have one. And like I said, I don't believe it was a real one, because I remember when I was taken into the dentist, he put that little hook in the back of my mouth. I was probably like 10 years old, 12 years old, whatever years old you are to have an adult tooth back there. And I remember him digging and digging and digging. And I'm like, well, and he goes, oh yeah, I think you have the start of a cavity. Well, sure. You just spent 15 minutes digging at it. And, we got that cavity, but I never had another one since. So shenanigans. But $215 for a toothbrush. Holy Christmas.
Yeah.
The suspect was caught on security camera leaving the store via the self-checkout line without paying. Anyone who can identify the suspect or has any information regarding this theft is asked to contact the Steinbach RCMP or Crime Stoppers. So for all of our Canadian listeners, both of you, I need you to, if you know anything about this, because I know in Canada you guys know everybody, I need you to just make this right. Turn this guy in. He can't be running around with $215 toothbrushes. $215 for a toothbrush. Good God.
That's not just a toothbrush. That's a dental system. Have you ever, you've never had like the water picks or any of that stuff?
Tim, I have 11 children between my wife and I. I'm lucky that I'm not sharing a toothbrush with my three eldest children. There is no extra money for $215 water picks and the like, Tim. I just, I can't even fathom what that must be, that kind of luxury.
It's not a luxury. Sometimes it's a dental necessity. Sometimes you've got...
Sometimes I just have a stick with gravel glued to the end, Tim. When things get rough. It's just I'm like a monkey. I dip it in hot glue and then roll it on gravel and that's it.
Huh. Sometimes you just take the towel. You're like Britney Spears. You just take the towel and you just rub your teeth on the towel. God, and you're...
That sounds gross.
You're just good to go for the day.
Yeah, no, yeah. Thanks. Mm-hmm. Oh, no.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. No, that's horrific.
Yeah.
That's horrific. I've got another weird story before we go into what seems to be a myriad of vehicular crimes. Let's go to Polk County, Florida, where a man stole lights from a triple homicide victim's grave because, well, they were pretty. Deputies say. Polk County deputies say a man stole solar lights from the grave of a man who was killed while on a fishing trip with two of his best friends in frostproof because he thought the lights were pretty. Records show Damian Tillman, 23, was buried at Evergreen Cemetery in Fort Meade after he and two other men were beaten and shot to death in July of 2020. Three arrests have since been made in connection with the triple homicide. Now, on January 13, Tillman's parents reported that solar lights were stolen from their son's gravesite. Polk County Sheriff Grady Judd said the couple wanted to know who was responsible. He was laid to rest in a grave in Fort Meade where solar lights placed in his grave by family and a worthless individual stole those lights, they said. Well, Mr. and Mrs. Tillman were outraged, as well as was everyone else that knew of this, but they went a step further. They installed a game camera that downloaded text and put more solar lights up, according to Judd. Deputies said at about 11:15 a.m. on Monday, the couple saw someone on the camera removing lights from their son's grave once again. So they immediately called authorities and provided a description of the suspect and his red truck. Guess what? We have caught us a thieving animal on a game camera. They notify the sheriff's office. We immediately responded and arrested Kevin Wheeler with more stolen lights from Damian Tillman's grave, Judd said. Wheeler, 45, was located during a traffic stop as deputies were responding to the cemetery, records show. Wheeler admitted that he had an interest with gravesite lights and was removing them because he thought they were pretty. He said, hey, I just like to steal the lights. They were kind of neat. I thought they were cool, so I stole them off a dead young man's grave who was viciously murdered, Judd said. The sheriff said the victim's parents did the right thing by setting up the camera. I applaud the Tillmans for putting up a game camera and catching a real animal. He's locked up in county jail for theft, so there's not enough negative things to say about him. He doesn't even deserve a what are you thinking, because he obviously doesn't have anything worth thinking about, said Judd. Ooh, double digs. Wheeler is facing charges of removing a monument and petty theft. His criminal history includes grand theft and vehicle theft charges, as well as receiving a special court martial by the U.S. Naval Criminal Investigative Services for making a bomb threat. Oh, so this guy's just a gem all the way around, Tim.
Yeah, he is.
But you can't blame him. The lights were pretty. The lights... we're pretty.
Just dig $39.95 out of your pocket and go get some yourself.
You cheap son of a bitch. Florida man has been accused of trying to steal horses and riding them home, deputies say. That's right, Lake County, Florida. A Florida man is behind bars after deputies say he tried to free horses from a local ranch. The Lake County Sheriff's Office's ranch owners reported several horse stalls were open and horses were on the loose. As the horses were being corralled, the owners told deputies they saw a man driving the owner's truck, according to the sheriff's office. One of the owners was able to stop the man, identified as Mark Anthony.
What?
Hunt. No, not our guy. Not our attorney, Mark Anthony.
Okay.
The guy's name is Mark Anthony Hunt, and detain him until deputies arrived. Authorities say when the owners asked Hunt why he opened the stalls, the 55-year-old told them that he didn't believe the horses should be caged. The Fruitland Park man also told owners he tried to mount one of the horses, ride it. Holy cow, but it got away from him, according to deputies. The sheriff's office says the horses are valued at $20,000 and $80,000 each. Deputies took Hunt into custody. He was booked into the Lake County Detention Center on burglary, grand theft auto, and grand theft charges. His bond is set at $15,000. Whew. 15 grand. All right. Our next, you're going to appreciate this one, Tim.
Okay.
Hunger can make people do some dumb things.
That's why they have Snickers commercials.
Yeah, like steal an ambulance to go on a fast food run. Well, that's what happened to Houston, Texas on Thursday night when paramedics were responding to a service call, according to the Houston Police Department. Paramedics were sent to an apartment complex in southwestern Houston shortly after 9 p.m. As paramedics were working, a man jumped in the ambulance and drove off. Police were able to track down the stolen ambulance through its GPS. The driver also made their job easier because the ambulance's emergency lights were left on. Officers found the vehicle in the drive-through lane of a Jack in the Box while the man was ordering food, according to police. The fast food joint is less than 5 miles away from where the ambulance was stolen. Police were able to arrest the alleged driver. Well, he's an alleged driver. You found him behind the wheel. To me, that removes alleged from the mix. It wasn't like he just, there's a running ambulance sitting at a Taco Bell or a Jack in the Box. I'm just going to climb in. This guy stole it. You've got him in the front seat.
You've never seen an ambulance sitting there and just went, I wonder what it's like to get behind the wheel of one.
Yeah, but I also have that voice in my head that goes, that would be counterproductive to remaining free. So I don't do that. The driver was later identified as Rinaldo Duchamp Leonard. He is facing a felony theft charge. No one was injured in the incident. Police say didn't say if the man ever got his order, though, Tim. So that's the real crime. Did he get that final sweet, sweet taste? Oh, their monster burgers, amazing, a Jack in the Box. I can kind of understand.
I'm sure if he didn't, they have plenty of good gruel in jail.
Good God.
Yeah.
Just stealing an ambulance. Need a little run up to the old Jack in the Box.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't have been funny if they'd have gotten there and he had put one of those Jack in the Box antenna balls on the ambulance. Two arrested after trying to recover drugs that they left in their rental car, says deputies. We're going to go to Albany, New York for this story. The Albany County Sheriff's Office say they've arrested two people after they say attempted to retrieve drugs from a returned rental car. The sheriff's office say they received a call on January 13th that drugs were found in a returned rental car. Investigators say when deputies arrived, they arrested Asim Hiltz and Sharif Frazier, who say they returned to the Albany County Airport to retrieve the forgotten drugs. The sheriff's office says Hiltz was discovered to be in possession of 140 glassine envelopes containing heroin, over 35 grams of MDMA, 62 counterfeit oxycodone pills pressed with fentanyl, and 10 Suboxone strips, a quantity of marijuana, and over $5,600 in cash. Frazier was in possession of marijuana, according to the investigators. Hiltz was charged with multiple counts of criminal possession of a controlled substance. Frazier was released on an appearance ticket for possession of marijuana. How high are you that you have that much drugs and money and you just forget it in your rental car?
I don't think he was high. I think he was just trying not to get caught with it.
That doesn't make any sense. And why would you go back for it? You wouldn't get caught with it. They left the drugs in the car, left, and then came back to the rental car company to pick up their drugs they forgot.
Well, he was probably very paranoid and thought somebody was on his tail, so he left it there and then he came back for it. You got to understand paranoia when it comes to when you're carrying that much stuff. Uh-huh. You're paranoid all the time.
How do you know, Tim? Tim, is that how you made your money in college? Were you a drug mule, Tim?
No, Dave.
Tim,
you got to
come clean, Tim.
Dave, you got to put yourself in the shoes of someone who's carrying that much stuff. Do you think you'd be cool?
I'm gonna love you, even if you are a criminal. Just tell me the truth.
Do you think you'd be cool as the other side of the pillow carrying that much stuff?
I don't know. I don't know.
You don't know?
Reminds me of a fun rental car story, Tim. I'd gone a number of years ago to the Glen Tavern Inn in California for an investigation, paranormal investigation. And my friend Bree, you remember Bree?
Mm-hmm.
Bree accompanied me, and we are both proud supporters of Air Supply, the band. Tim, not to the breathing air. We like that too. But we brought our Air Supply's Greatest Hits CD, plugged it in said rental car, and sang along to it the entire drive from the airport to the Glen Tavern Inn. And then we enjoyed it so much on the way back again, the two of us just howling at the top of our lungs to Air Supply. We get there, and I look at her, and I said, you know what? I'm going to leave this CD, not because of paranoia, Tim, but because I wanted to share the wealth of the beauty that is Air Supply. I left that CD in the CD player. We took off. As we're walking, maybe 30 feet from the car, I hear, Señor! Señor! And this guy comes running up, and he goes, you forgot your CD! And I said, no, we're going to leave that for the next listener. And he looks at it and he goes, no, senor.
This is a crime against humanity, senor.
This is no good. No bueno, senor. Yes. No mas.
No.
So I was forced to take it back.
Yeah.
All right.
As you should have been. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Our final story is here. And I don't know, because it's from a foreign country, Tim.
Mm-hmm.
I can't tell you what country because I don't understand half of this, and it is poorly translated, but I just love the headline, man killed while bedding stepmom in her bush.
What?
Two Chepigny men who killed their half-brother by pulling his privates after catching him being intimate with their mother in her bush were jailed 15 years apiece by High Court Judge Charles Hungwe. Lloyd Makuzuki and Hard Life Chimoko Sithole, I said Sithole, Tim.
Well, I bet you did.
Were convicted of murdering Siahamba Makakuzi.
Mm-hmm.
The pair were denying the charges. Mr. Jonathan Chingwinyaso prosecuted. Now, in his defense, Makakuzi told the court that he had been provoked and shocked to find his stepbrother being intimate with his mother in the bush.
Attaboy.
But then the other side, I guess. Oh, no, the yard bushes. Okay. Huh, interesting. He said he acted uncontrollably and lashed out. He lashed the deceased with switches and a belt. Ugh. Makuzuki denied pulling the now deceased's private parts. A postmortem confirmed Sibihamba's genitals were pulled.
No.
Oh, God. What does that mean? How do you, are they like hanging by his knees so they know somebody grabbed him and gave him a slinky tug or what?
I'm guessing it's not like milking the cow out in the barn.
Sithole, I said Sithole, said he warned Makuzuki against pulling Siahamba's private parts as it would lead to death.
Mm-hmm.
In her testimony, the pair's mother, Juliet Makuzuki, denied ever being intimate with the deceased. Makuzuki said she would have chosen a better place instead of a bush. She also said it was not taboo in the Ndu culture for his stepson to inherit his late father's estate and wives.
Well, if not in the bush, where? The back door?
I guess.
Hmm.
Good grief. Yeah. Well, that's it for Dumb Crime, Stupid Criminals this week, kids. I wish I had more to share, but I don't. That's it. That's the end of the story. Special thanks to Dr. Cyril Wecht. What a heavy hitter to get on the show. It was great to have him on and join us today. Thank you so much, Dr. Wecht. We hope you enjoyed today's program. We'll be back tomorrow. We have a special edition of Darkness Radio in remembrance of the Holocaust. Tomorrow is Holocaust Remembrance Day. We will be doing our interview tomorrow. And on Thursday, we will have our Supernatural News Parashare edition. The hunt for Bigfoot is on, Tim. I just want you to know that. That's a little teaser for Thursday. Friday, we'll be back with a brand new episode of Darkness Radio Presents Holzer's Ghosts. We'll be taking a look at the Devil in Texas case with our special guest, Reverend Bill Bean. We'll be talking about possession, that case, and more. So make sure you check that out on Friday. That's what you got in store this week. Thank you for tuning in and spending some time with us here on the best in true crime talk radio. And remember, go subscribe to Darkness Radio on Stitcher or any podcast device that you listen, because you can always find the best in paranormal talk radio right now, 3 days a week, every Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. All right. Take care, everyone. We'll see you again next week with more True Crime Tuesday.